So for June, Kelly had the opportunity to speak with author Nathan Whitaker on the book that he co-authored with Tony Dungy, Leaning on the Promises of God for Men. And I'm hoping that everybody had a chance to get that book. If not, then definitely get out there and get it. Now, on this episode of The Word with an Inquisitive Book Nerd, Kelly had the opportunity to sit down with a friend of ours. And if you're a fan of Prince, then you're going to love this one. My name's Rich Bennett with Harford County Living, and it is my pleasure to introduce to you award-winning author and editor, Kelly White, The Word with an Inquisitive Book Nerd.
Of The Word with an Inquisitive Book Nerd, and I'm here with Dwayne Tudall, author of, Dwayne, will you say the title of that book? It's a mouthful.
Sure. Prince and the Parade and Sign of the Times Era Studio Sessions, 1985 and 1986. Yes, it's a very easy, right off the tongue book title. I know. It wasn't thought out very cleverly, I have to admit.
So it's a book about Prince and his studio sessions, and this is the second in a series of books.
Correct. The first book came out in November of 2017, and the paperback came out in November of 2018, and this is the second volume. So the first volume was called Prince and the Purple Rain Era Studio Sessions, which is a lot easier to say, and now I've got two albums in the second book, so I'm like going, okay, this is a little more complicated. But the first book covered 1983 and 1984, and this covers 1985 and 1986.
Now, I would imagine that there are going to be more books in this series.
I hope so. But I will tell you, they take a lot out of me just putting the things together. It's 2 or 3 years of research and writing every day, and as you know, as a writer, you working every day and every night and every holiday. It's a lot of work. I have to always explain that to people.
You know, I want to talk to you about that, Dwayne. I want to talk to you about your process because it's very, very, the content of your books, both of them, very, very detailed. You clearly had to talk to a lot of people who were in Prince's circle. I would imagine a lot of interviewing, and I'm curious, did you interview these people in person? Did you talk to them by phone? Were you in communication with them through emails?
Sure.
Because, you know, you clearly have some dialogue transcribed because there's word for word quotes from these people who were so close to Prince.
What I did, the first book took about 20 years, and I don't suggest that to anybody. it took about 20 years of research and even deciding to do a book, but it's even then still writing all the time. I got to the point in the beginning of 2016 where I'd been working on other books for other people, but I decided to put all the stuff into my book and thought, well, I'll do a book about his studio sessions because there's a book called The Beatles Studio Sessions that I really liked. It's covered what the Beatles did from 1962 to 1970. And they interviewed some of the people around it. And it was cool because you learn the dates and the times and when things are going. You look up your birthday and you go, oh, they recorded this song on my birthday. That's kind of fun. And I thought, I'm a big fan of Prince. So I thought, okay, let me try that. And I'd been interviewing people for other books for other people. And I thought, well, I can do this myself. And so I started talking to people. First, it was in person. Back in the day, you could do more of those in person. A lot of people were in Los Angeles, so I went to the studios he was recording in. They gave me all the work orders and details. I interviewed most of the engineers and then some of the band members and things like this, and that started really working out well. And then some people, we did phone interviews, and I'd have those transcribed. I found a fairly cheap transcription service. At first I was paying, you know, for a full transcription, but there's some fairly cheap transcription services that'll pay for like a 25 cents for a minute, and they'll do a rough one through a computer, and then you can go through and just kind of listen to it and see if it is accurate. And that was very helpful for saving money because transcribing things, as you know, is a lot, or a lot of time. It's either time or money. So when you're doing something like this, you want to make sure you're doing it word for word and accurate, because if you're going to quote people, you want to make sure you're as accurate as possible, because they're going to tell the story. My goal in a thing like this, I for a little background on myself, I'm a documentarian. I worked making documentaries for years, either as an editor or director or producer for 30 years or so, reality TV. Yeah, exactly. Reality TV and documentaries, and some films. And you kind of realize it's stories like this are often told best through the people who were there. Obviously, if you're doing something about the Revolutionary War, you're somewhat limited on who you can interview for that. But you can use letters or things like that from that period. But if you've got contemporary stories with people, you have the option of reaching out to these people. And if they interview with you, it's great because it gives you the personality things. I always learned when I was interviewing people is you can ask people what or who, and that's one, you're not going to get an open-ended question answer. But if you ask somebody a why question, like why did you do this or why would he do this, and then you be quiet, you often get people who will explain even more about what they were doing, and just kind of you step back and let them, you know, like, talk about it, which you're like doing with me. And and that helps, because you get, sometimes that's when you start getting the most honest answers, because people feel like they want to fill the air and they feel like they should be talking. So that's where I get that from. And then I started doing research. I went to the Library of Congress in DC. I went to the unions where the musicians were through. A lot of interviews with the musicians who had dates and track informations. Went to Warner Brothers and they gave me some more information. So it was like, it just kept building. And then you go back to the people to kind of check it again. This is the information I learned. It's a little bit different than what you said. And they will either figure out one of the sides is needs to bend a little bit. And that's where that went. So it was really a lot of work. And then the first book, so you get a little background, I finished at in March of 2016. Prince died in April of 2016, so 1 month after I'd finished the book. And I toyed with the idea of not coming out with the book because I thought, I don't want to be that guy, you know, looking like an ambulance chaser. And so I reached out to the people.
Was he aware? Was he aware?
No, I don't. People say that he was aware. I never had any correspondence with him. I did not know him. Okay. But I've had a few people who knew him said that he did know about it. I don't know. I wrote it as a tribute to him. So hopefully he'd read it, he'd enjoy it, and not be too litigious about it. It's always that fear. But I wrote it in a way that was respectful and honest. And I did want him to read it because I thought that would have been fun to get his perspective.
Had you made any attempts to reach out to him as a contributor?
I did early on for another project, but not for that book. I don't think I reached out for the Studio Sessions book.
Okay.
I don't think I was. I went back and forth. If you reach out to somebody like that too early, they could put up roadblocks, and they could stop you. Right. And I didn't want to be stopped. He sued a lot of people for, you know, a lot of different things. I didn't want to be. And he had more money than I did. He could always hold me up in court if he wanted to. And not that I was saying anything bad, because I really it's done with respect and honesty. But I didn't want to have any issues like that at all. So I didn't, okay. Unfortunately. And I wish I had talked to him, because I would have loved. I have a series of questions. I even kept a little log of the questions I would have asked him. And yeah, unfortunately, they're no longer valid.
What would have been the first thing that you would have asked him had you had the chance?
Wow. I think the first thing I would have asked would be how he assembles a song, how he creates a song. Is it because what I've heard is from the engineers or the band members that he would start with the drums and then grab the bass and things like this. But I wondered what his process was. You know, did he hear the song in his head? Somebody told me a story that they were just getting ready to go out to dinner in the studio with Prince, and he walked across the floor and he heard his boots clicking on the floor and he's like, wait, and he went back to the drums and hit that and started playing that beat. And he said, dinner's gonna have to wait. And so you realize this guy's always processing, always had his antennas always up, always looking for whatever the sound is or the lyric, and somebody tells him a joke or somebody makes a mistake in what they're saying or just a funny comment, all of a sudden that could be placed inside a song, a title of a song, or a punchline of a song. And so you realize that everybody around him influenced him in some way, and everything around him, whether it was other music he heard, or, you know, like just walking across the floor, or somebody, you know, whatever it is, he processed it into music. You know, I think there's certain people in life that I personally process things with humor. I hear something and I think, oh, that could be funny. How can that be funny? Well, here's the angle I would do on it. And I think you're a little bit like that too. Finding things that are clever or funny or insightful or just entertaining, finding a way through what you see as being entertaining and finding a way to make it into something.
Well, you are art. in the entertainment industry.
There it is.
So I want to let our listeners know, because I do like to give preference to local authors, that you are a Harford County alum.
Yes. Oops. So I heard a dog.
That was my dog. I just had to lock her out of the room. So okay. I apologize for that. So you're a Harford County.
I have four dogs upstairs right now. We've only owned two, but I may have to apologize later when my dogs start barking. So,
well, I think everybody's experienced a little bit of this. I've done a lot of Zoom meetings. In fact, I teach online courses and that sort of thing. Okay. And I can tell the people that have kids at home, their hair's kind of sticking up all over the place. And inevitably, the kids always walk in and jump on their lap or.
Right. You know. Right.
So there's been a lot of that sort of thing lately. But I do want to let our listeners know that you're a Harford County alum, that The Word Within an Inquisitive Book Nerd is a spinoff from Harford County Living. And we do like to give preference to local authors. And you are from Joppa Town, correct? You graduated from Joppa Town High School?
I did. I graduated in 1982. Yeah. I grew up in Baltimore and Joppa Town. Joppa Town, literally went to school in Joppa Town from kindergarten to senior in high school. So yeah, that was a great place to grow up.
Now, were your school papers as well researched as your books are?
No, I squeaked by. I did just enough to get by. Literally,
I am really. Really, really impressed with the level of research in these books. So I have to wonder what your schoolwork was like.
No, it's funny because one of my teachers, Miss Moody, reached out to me. And we've been in touch for years on and off, but she reached out to me recently and I told her about this and I sent her a book. She's like, oh my gosh. And she's a creative writing teacher. So I was like, thank you for helping me with this stuff. But I back in the day, it was more just, you know, kind of what can I do that's humorous and, you know, what can I get by with? And then you can't do that if you're supposed to do a scholarly book. You kind of have to spend a few hours looking it up. So I spent 20 years.
You know, as well researched as your book is, and it does have sort of almost an encyclopedic quality to it because it's that detailed, but it still reads like, you know, a piece of creative nonfiction. It's a good fun to read. It's intriguing.
Thank you. My thought when I was doing it is I wanted to have something that is both factual, so you can, you know, the Prince nerd and the music nerd in me would be able to look things up, but also as a story from beginning to end with pieces that like a mystery. You know, an author's job is to reveal whatever information they want revealed when they want it revealed. And so you don't give away the whole story in the beginning. So it's the story of a man's life, and it's just 2 years of the man's life. And both books have this told through the people who are around him and with me organizing it, and kind of getting out of the way as much as possible. And looking at his music and how his music was his diary in many ways. Lyrics for his songs would be his way of speaking. For a guy that didn't do many interviews, he talked a lot in his songs. And so I wanted to see if I could get that out there. And that was kind of fun. So the fact that somebody would read it and see that it's a hopefully a concise story from beginning, middle to end is great. I just got a review in Variety. They really liked it. And there was a review in Rolling Stone in Germany, and they seem to like it. They gave it a 5-star. So I feel like sometimes it may be connecting with some people, which is really helpful. Really happy.
I pulled it up on Amazon, and it has that coveted little number one bestseller tag on it.
So I saw that too.
For that.
Thank you. No, I saw that. That's kind of fun. I don't put that on the cover of the book saying, you know, number one bestseller, because it's in a category, but it's very, I love the fact that people are enjoying it. I want to do more of these, and I love that there's an enthusiasm and excitement about it. I think that's one of the fun things when you're writing. Go ahead, sorry.
I think it's okay to claim those tags, even if it's in a category.
All right. I'll do it.
I would.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, well, it's a fun thing. It's been, I you know, when you write something, you do it in silence. You're doing it at home by yourself, and you don't know whether anybody's going to enjoy what you're doing. And it's always that fear of, you know, you're throwing a football down the field and just hoping there's somebody that's going to be catching it. And I think every author probably goes through that, or any person in entertainment, really, your playwright or person who makes music videos or anything, just songs. There's a combination of fear of when you're writing and arrogance, in the sense that when you're writing something, you're thinking, I'm asking other people to spend a week or two reading something I wrote that I think is important. And that's a big thing to ask. It's like, you know, when you write a song, you're saying, I want you to sit there for 4 minutes listening to me sing this song. I'm so important that you should be listening to what I'm doing. And there's a bit of that. And that's the terrible fear that I'm fooling myself into thinking that people are going to care. And it's always nice to hear that people do sometimes.
Now,
if that
you
makes
mentioned
sense.
Earlier that you were doing interviews for other people's books. What's that about? I know that your background is in TV and film, but why are you interviewing for other people's books?
There's some people that were I wrote for a magazine called Uptown Magazine for several years, and it was a magazine out of Sweden that was based on the Minneapolis music scene, and that would include Prince or people around him. And so I interviewed people for articles for that, but also the main guy who was in that, a guy named Pierre Nilsson, was writing several books, and they were about Prince. And so I was one of the researchers, West Coast researcher for his books. So I would interview people that were local in Los Angeles. So I got to know a lot of these people through researching his project. And then other people were writing other books, and they'd ask me, can you hook me up with this engineer or this band member? And I would, you know, oftentimes try to be the middle person to do that. And so I knew a good deal of these people, and that kind of helped. So I knew I had a relationship with some of them when I went in to talk to them. And that was very helpful, you know, because if they already knew me for several years and knew of my work, it really helped. And but even then, with that, my first book, I could only get certain people because they had no idea what I was doing. They're like, this sounds like a kind of a crazy idea. I think everybody should have crazy ideas when they're writing, because if your idea is not crazy, then it means somebody else has probably already done it. But I would, after the first book came out, a lot of the people that didn't talk to me came out and said, okay, I've read it now. I see what you were doing. I get it. Would you like to talk now? And I'm like, well, I've kind of already done the book, but I could do a paperback with some extended stuff. So I did an expanded paperback with about 30 extra pages that were folded into the book, not in like one section, but throughout the entire book, where people would add interviews and comments and new songs and sessions that I'd never heard about. And so or fix things. You know, sometimes when you write a book like this, when you release it, oftentimes the first version, you try to be as accurate as possible, but oftentimes it's like the peer review. And some of these people may look at it and say, you know, that's accurate, but it could be here is a little bit more accurate, or you got a typo there or something like that, which is always a big fear. You know, you write a book with a 250,000 words and you're still dreading those 2 or 3 words that are typos in
yeah,
there.
I know that. I was a magazine editor for a lot of years, and I swear every issue that came out, the typo popped out.
Yep.
The minute you opened up one page that has a typo.
Yeah, and you're like, and you remember that one. It's the one thing.
Yeah.
I know. And then you find yourself like wanting to apologize for that one typo for the whole magazine. Magazine's great, but this is one typo. I apologize, man.
Right.
It's like the bad review you get. You know, you have 10 great
that.
Reviews, and one bad review, and you're like, oh, that one guy. Can I tell you a funny story about a bad review of something? When I first announced the book was coming out, there was one person that, people were sharing. I posted on Facebook, I got a book coming out. Here's the company. I was with a publisher named Roman Littlefield. And this is coming out at this date. And it's going to cost this amount of money. And everybody was really excited. You know, there was a buzz. But first book, I'm like looking at everybody's share when they're all sharing it. And it's like 200 shares. And there was one guy that said, "Who is this guy, Dwayne Tudall? Why is he writing about Prince? And why is this book so expensive?" And I reached out to him and I said, I didn't set the price. You know, it's not, here's what I did for the book is 20 years of research and here's what it covers. And I hope you want to read it. And I was very nice. And we went back and forth, you know, very pleasantly and left it at that. And about 6 months later, I was, before the book came out, I was traveling. And I was in Minneapolis and I was coming back from something in Minneapolis and I was standing at the airport and this guy has his Prince clothes and stuff like this on. And we're talking. And I said, "Oh, I'm a fan of Prince," and introduced myself. And we started talking. It was Southwest. So we said, "Why don't we sit together? We can talk on the way back to Los Angeles." And I said, "That's great." And we got in the seats. We started talking. We had a lot in common. And he said, "I got to tell you something. I wrote something bad about you online." I was like, "You're the guy." I said, "You're the guy." And he's like, "What do you mean?" I said, "There's only one guy out there." And I said, "Is your name this?" And he said, "Yeah." And I was like, "You're it." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry about that. You seem very pleasant," everything like that. And I told him, "You know, tell you what, I've got my computer here and the book isn't out. Do you want to read the first 30 pages? Or you want to look through it?" And he's like, "Yeah." So he took my computer and we had about a half an hour of silence where he's reading. And he goes, "Oh my God, this is, I love this." And he went from being this harsh critic to a big, a big supporter. And he's written things about it and we've become great friends, but it was like, because we didn't fight and because we were pleasant to each other, but also because it was what he wanted. He wanted to read this and it turned out to be something he liked. And, it's just hilarious that the universe conspired for us to sit next to each other on a plane.
Pretty amazing. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. But every time we talk to each other, we laugh about the fact that, you know, we sat next to each other in the plane. He went into the plane not liking me. And we left, he liked the whole project. And now he's like, the second book came out, he was like the first one out there, "You guys got to buy this book." And I'm like, that's very nice of me. So yeah, you never know where the praise and the support is going to come from. So it's kind of fun.
So here's a crazy idea. Have you thought about blending your love of Prince and the book with your filmmaking background and documentary making?
Daily. Yes. I think about that. I think in terms of visuals on everything. And so yes, I was just thinking about this about a half an hour ago. I was thinking how cool it would be to be able to put this into a documentary. In fact, when I made my negotiated my contract with the publisher, that was one of the things that I said, I want to own the rights to any sort of documentaries on this because I it's what I do for a living and you never know. And they said, "Oh, we probably wouldn't do anything with it anyway." So I'm like, yes, then I would definitely want this to maintain this. So yeah, I've thought about that. Obviously there's all kinds of hurdles with that. And I'd signed, this several years ago, who knows? But wouldn't that be fun to be able to do a documentary on what you love? You know,
that would be amazing.
That'd be great. Yeah. So who knows? You know, maybe sometime down the road. Right now I'm writing books. I would love to put some of this into a documentary, if the powers that be would want me to do that, I would be happy to do it.
So I know that Prince just had a birthday on June 7th.
Yes.
And I had noticed that, or I had in my notes anyway, that your book initially was supposed to release on June 7th.
Correct.
But then I think the release date changed to June 10th.
Yeah, they had it shifted 3 days, which is interesting because I'm like, really, we couldn't find 3 days in the system to get, what is it, that 3 day thing? Oh no, we can't do that. And I thought, okay, all right. It seems like a good day for it. But they said, no, it probably can't. I think what it was, they just want to make sure they had some leeway just in case. Cause we got to the end where we were, going back and forth with tiny mistakes. I was locating, they would say, "Well, this is the last pass." I'll say, okay. And then as soon as I'd press send, I go, wait, what's this? You know? So it was one of these things that we went back and forth on a lot of things. And, I'm sure they sat there going, really, dude, you got to knock it off. But my thought is, at the end of the day, my name's on the cover of the book. And 20 years from now, that book's going to be on the shelf. And they're not going to be walking into the bookstore saying, that's me. Or nobody's going to pick the book up and say, did you do this book? But I will. And so I think with every author, they should get it the way they want it, you know, and because I'd rather, like most people, I'd rather fail on my own than succeed with somebody else's vision. You know, I want, when a person's writing, they're kind of writing what's in them. And it's one of those things that you don't have to do by committee. And there's something charming about being able to express whatever it is you're thinking and feeling in a book, and knowing that when you hand it in, it has your name on the cover for a reason. And so I think what they wanted, because I pushed it, I have to admit, I pushed it hard, whether it was the cover art or the advertising or any aspect of it, I really made sure that it kind of was, I don't want to say approved, but you know, it was within the brand, if you want to say. So we pushed it, and they finally said, I don't know whether we can make it out by June 7th. And I said, okay, what are you thinking? Because I thought end of June would be fine if we have to. And they said, June 10th. And I'm like, okay, so we're talking hours here. Okay. Yeah, so it was like, okay, it's that same week. All right. And so, yeah, so June 10th was the release of the book. Yeah. But it's fine. I mean, I'm just happy to have the book out. You know, it's one of those things where you just, you know, when you're writing, you just think, first off, is it going to be received? And is it going to even get out or in another person's hands? Because at that point, it's still this nebulous thing on your computer or on your, you know, art canvas or something like that, that you just hope that one day you don't have to explain to people what it is. You can hand it to them and say, I'll be in the next room. You come talk to me when you're done. That's a nice thing.
So after you wrote the first book, you were contacted by Prince's estate to manage that.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah. What happened was, after the first book came out, which is the first book, so everybody understands what the first book is about. First book is called Prince and the Purple Rain Era Studio Sessions, 1983 and 1984. It came out, and they reached out to me and said, are you interested in working with the Prince estate? And this is after Prince had passed, and they have to archive all of his stuff. And they had decided to take the stuff from Minneapolis to Los Angeles. And that was in the papers and everything like this. I'm not saying anything out of school by saying that, but they reached out to me and asked me if I'd be interested in this. And I'm like, well, yeah. Yeah. Would I like that? Yeah. And so, but the funny thing is, my wife and our daughter, we were all talking about moving to Colorado at the time. And they were actually in Colorado looking at houses when this call came in. And so I called my wife and I said, what do you think? And she said, okay, let's give it a year. Say yes. But she said, of course you're going to say yes. If you said no, I wouldn't believe another thing you said in your life. This is a dream job. And if you didn't take this, you'd be, you know, it's one of those deathbed jobs where you're sitting there going on your deathbed, why didn't I do this? You know, why didn't I, you know, whatever. And that would be on your list of things that you're angry at yourself about. And so I took it it went really well. I'm still working with them. And so I kind of oversee a lot of their stuff. I'm listed as the senior researcher and producer for several things. I do the liner notes for several of their albums and things like this. Now, granted, I don't talk about it much when I'm promoting my book. I try not to make the book and my job two separate things. When I'm working for the job, I do that. And when I'm working for my book, to do that, I don't cross them over. My research is not involving the vault. I'm not supposed to be speaking about things that I find exclusively there. My research is all about what I found out outside the vault. They're not paying me to write a book. And so that's fair. I think that's completely fair. And in all honesty, I spent 20 years researching this before I even stepped in the vault. And so I knew, you know, a great deal of what was going on. That's why they basically hired me, because they felt like he's already done a lot of the work. And so that's how it worked out.
Really. What exactly is that? Is that something at Paisley Park?
All his music has been moved to, all his stuff has been moved to Los Angeles so they can have it digitized and archived easier. Okay. Paisley Park didn't have the facilities to be, doing some of that. And so that's where it is. It's in Los Angeles. And I lived in Los Angeles at the time. So it was really convenient that I knew the stuff and I would live there so I could go and help them figure out what they had for certain projects, you know, if that makes sense. When you talk about a vault, it's basically what Prince used to have is it was commonly referred to as his vault, where he kept all of his music and video and film and everything else and stills. And so all that stuff is now in another vault in Los Angeles.
So. Now, I just read that that one of the musicians from Lamb of God and some other like really hardcore heavy metal dudes recorded a cover of I Would Die For You. Are you familiar with that?
I haven't heard that one, but they do this all the time. And I think that the fun thing to me about Prince's music is it gets covered by a lot of people. Prince is one of those few musicians that is respected by critics, other musicians, and fans. You don't get a lot of, you know, you get certain ones, but usually you get somebody that's critically acclaimed and doesn't sell albums, or other people like their stuff. You know, bands that are big but don't get the critical acclaim. It's like Aerosmith or Kiss. Critics hate them, but, you know, their fans love them. So it's tough to find somebody who kind of gets all of those. And Prince is one of those things. So when people do covers, it's kind of fun to hear. I don't always enjoy every cover, but, you know, he's got 40 albums and then another 100 albums of unreleased stuff, you know. So he's got a lot of stuff people could do covers of. And it's sometimes fun to hear somebody interpret a song by somebody. You know, it's like Bob Dylan wrote a lot of cool songs. And Hendrix covered things. I didn't even know there were Bob Dylan songs until I found, you know, later, oh, that was written by Dylan? Okay. And that's, I think, if you got a good song, it's a good song. And it's always fun to hear another artist interpret it. You know, Sinead O'Connor did a great version of Nothing Compares to You. You know, things like that. So you can find different musicians that do really good versions of something. Like they may add something that wasn't expected. And that's sometimes very fun.
You know, speaking of Sinead O'Connor, she just wrote in her memoir that she had a kind of a harrowing experience with him, with Prince, where she was, I don't know, felt physically threatened.
I've read that. I don't know a thing about it because it's not an era I've really researched.
Obviously. I was curious to know if anybody that you talked to ever mentioned anything about his temper.
That was a surprise to me too. No, that was a surprise to me too. So I was kind of sad to hear that. But no, I don't know anything about that, unfortunately.
Yeah, she mentioned his stepbrother. Well, she called him his brother, but I saw in your book that it was actually his stepbrother named Dwayne.
Named Dwayne, spelled the same too. So
that wasn't
me though. Yeah, exactly. That wasn't me though. Yeah, it's funny because people have said, "Oh, Dwayne gave them this." I'm like, "Which Dwayne? I don't know anything about that." Yeah, I don't know any details other than what she said. And he's not here to say the other side, so I don't know. But that's a subject that I've never, because it's in an era I'm not familiar, and I'm familiar with, but not familiar with those sessions and those interpersonal relationships. I remember being a big fan of Sinead O'Connor's version. I loved her first album, and I saw her play at the Wiltern back in probably 87 or 88 on her first album, and I really liked her voice and everything like this. I don't know the story behind this much other than what she said, so. Yeah. And I try to make sure my book is not filled with stories of innuendo and gossip and things like this, because I don't know what happened. And so
you can see that when you read it. Everything in your books are very factual, very fact-based and well-researched. Clearly, you've done your homework.
Thank you. I try to, when I do use quotes from people, I try to put, I think every quote is either from me, so it's firsthand, or I get it from a secondary source, and I cite these sources in the back of the book. So there's like 30 or 40 or 50 pages of citations in the back, because I figure if somebody else is doing the work to interview somebody, whether it's Prince or a band member or somebody else, I want to make sure I credit them and link them, people to them. So if you're reading the book and you see something that is of interest, you can look it up in the back and say, oh, I'd like to read that article. You can either find it online or find it in a magazine. And I think that's one of these things that's really helpful. I get frustrated when I read a book that has all kinds of great historical details that doesn't tell you where they come from. And because I sometimes go, oh, I'd love to know more about that, or where that came from, and or what context that was said. And so this one is a way to allow people not only to verify what I've said or the information that I'm putting forth, but also to research things on their own, to see there's more details of these stories out there, find the authors of these things and give them some love. You know, buy that magazine, buy that book, watch that interview, because if you're going to do the work for something, you should be credited for that. And I always thought that, I always feel like that when I read books that are, you know, citing a lot of things. I know it's not a scientific novel or anything like that, but it is a, at times scholarly, but entertaining. And I just want to make sure people understand where the information comes from.
Now, what about this music release that's coming out posthumously this summer, Welcome to America? Are you involved in any way in that as
yes.
the archivist?
Yes.
About that?
I can talk to you a little bit about that. The music we found on this is stuff that Prince had recorded. He wanted to create an album, and he put the songs together to make an album, and then decided not to release it. It's a great album. It's got a lot of fun songs on it. And the interesting thing is he did a whole tour called Welcome to America that he played for about 2 years and never came out with the album. So it's a album that he wanted to do. In fact, he created a whole tour around this and yet didn't end up releasing the album. And this is his thing, is just because he wants something on a Monday doesn't mean that he wants it on a Tuesday or even Monday afternoon. He may be like, you know what, that's a great idea. And then he gets distracted. Oh, squirrel, you know, and we'll go in another direction, or artistically say, you know what, this doesn't speak to me as much as I wanted to at that moment. That was great for then, but I've moved on, or I've done something new. And I want that released. And so he was very much like that. The nice thing about this album is there's a video with it, a concert that was done at the Forum in Los Angeles in April of 2011, which is 10 years ago, right around now. And it's a it's shot on high def, and it's a beautiful show. And it's probably the cleanest looking show, except for his movie Sign of the Times that has been released of his. It's beautiful. It's entertaining. Prince is so fun and so such an amazing showman, and his band is tight. And it's just that's a Blu-ray that comes with it if you order it like that. And it's worth that alone is worth the price of admission. But I love what the estate does with their new releases. They find pictures and essays, and they go back to the people who worked on these things, and they talk to them and get context. And it's kind of what I do, the same thing I do with my books, is put Prince's music in context of where things were with life and things like that. So I think it's going to really kind of blow some minds when people hear it.
It's almost like it's coming out with provenance.
Yeah, it's what's fun is oh my gosh, it is so timely what he's singing about. And when we heard some of this stuff, we thought he could have written this last week. You know, it talks about struggles and conflicts and things like this, and there's some hopeful songs on there too. But it's like you sit there going, wow, this guy was 10 years ahead of this. Either that or we haven't solved anything, which is probably half of it. But it is a testament to how good the guy was that he could write something back 10 years ago that's just as timely and just as important now. And that's kind of fun. I can't wait till people get to hear this. You know, I think people are going to really enjoy it.
You've heard it, obviously.
Yes, yes.
What would be your review or your critique of this release?
10 out of 10.
Kidding? Well, you know,
does it go to 11?
Well, it's interesting to me because you start out this your most recent book. You start out in 1985, and there's sort of this tone of Prince's, you know, reached the pinnacle of his success, and how is he going to top what he's already done? And it's sort of how I felt in 1979 when Pink Floyd came out with The Wall, you know.
Wall, exactly. How do you top it? You
know, how do they ever top that? So would you say that Welcome to America tops, you know, things?
Is this greatest thing ever? No. Okay. I will explain this. First off, I agree with you with the wall. But I did like the final cut. I like the final cut a lot, just so you know. There's albums that Prince has done that I really like, and there's albums that are not quite for me. But any artist is going to be who's pushing their boundaries are going to have sometimes where certain fans peel off for a little bit, and he's like, "Well, meet me on the other side of this, and it's great," you know. And that's what you do is maybe an album. I'm a big David Bowie fan, and it's like, okay, he may do something. I'm going, yeah, that's not for me, but I'll see you on the next one, you know, kind of thing. And you kind of accept that. This one I really like. Is it Purple Rain? No. Is anything Purple Rain? No. But it's more political than almost any album I remember him doing in a way that I think is insightful. I think there's a lot of vision in this. It has a cover of a song on it that I really liked by Soul Asylum. And it's what's fun about it to me, it's got a song called Yes, which I really like a lot. There's several, it's just a good album. I mean, I really kind of hope, I'm looking forward to the reviews because it's fun to peek into what somebody was doing that you didn't know about, you know, especially with an artist like that. You know, I enjoy when the Jimi Hendrix family comes out with new albums of his stuff, you know. And I like when you can get an insight into somebody who that you might not have gotten. I enjoy when you can see the sketches of Rembrandt or Picasso, you know, that weren't always intended, but there's sometimes you can see a little bit of where they were at the time, and it puts things into perspective.
Well, I can't wait to hear it.
Good.
So I also had, you know, I don't know where I heard this, but I think it was, you know, those little factoids that pop up on your TV when it's on screensaver.
Sure.
Do you get
that? Oh yeah. Oh yes. I get things like that.
I think that might actually be where I saw this, but I saw that his, I guess here we are on the heels of his birthday, but also the 5th year anniversary of his death, that his ashes were on display at Paisley Park.
It wasn't okay. I think that's a little misnomer. He was cremated very quickly after he passed away. The ashes aren't on display. The ashes are in a container, and you could see the container. You're not seeing ashes.
Well, I figured that they were in a container.
Yeah, but I know they did. They for a while when you the early on they had it as one of the first things you saw when you went to Paisley Park, and they changed that a little bit. I haven't been on a tour officially at Paisley Park since the beginning when they started doing tours. But I think that it was one of these things that they want to have people be able to pay their respects. I don't know if you've ever been to Graceland in Memphis. And
I have not.
The last part of the tour is on your way out, you pass by Elvis's grave. It's Elvis's grave and his mom's grave and his father's grave. And I think his twin brother's grave. And you kind of can take a little moment to just think about him and reflect. And I think that's probably what they're doing with this, is out of respect. That's what I think was done with that. I think it was Paisley Park was where he lived, where he worked, where he built it from scratch. And he died there. And so he's got a lot of his story there. And so I understand them wanting to have him there for that. And there's some people that didn't think that was in good taste, I guess, or that they're just not happy with it. You know, I don't know. I think there's a lot of people that really got something being able to connect with Prince and being able to be close to where he was. And whether you're in his old building, his home, the place he passed away, or near his ashes, just like going to a grave and taking some time with somebody you may have known or loved or known of. I go to people's graves and spend a little time. And when I went to Graceland, I spent a little time at Elvis's grave, just kind of thinking and reflecting and going, he went way too early. And I think that that's what they wanted to offer to people with having his ashes there. That's my guess. I have no idea, but that's my speculation on that.
Well, and I also, it's been a lot in the news a lot lately, and I think I saw this one on one of those screensavers too. And I just watched Purple Rain. I think I told you that. I just watched the
movie. Yes, yes, yeah.
And Clarence Williams, the actor who played his dad in that movie, passed away, I think, the day before his birthday. Yeah. And he's also the guy who was on Mod Squad.
Link on Mod Squad, yes.
Yes, yes.
That's how I knew him. I knew him growing up as Link.
Yeah. Right.
No, and he was the ringer they brought in for. He was the actor they brought in for the movie. Everybody else in the movie was not really an actor. So,
okay, so now Dwayne, our age is hanging out all over the place. And, but you know, I know from chit chatting with you a little bit on Facebook that you're also a huge fan of the Monkees.
Yes.
So, do you plan to do any projects or books related to the Monkees?
I don't. I would love to. I would love to do a documentary on them. I would love to. I've gone to see them perform. I people laugh that I like the Monkees. My taste is very wide. I used to work for a radio station in Towson. I went to Towson back when it was Towson State. Now it's Towson University. But I used to work at the radio station there, and the motto for the radio station was "From Bach to Rock," where they play classical and they play rock. And I really like that range for what I like musically. And the Monkees are some of the best pop songs you're going to find. You know, "Last Train to Clarksville" is a great song, things like that. So I enjoy. They're just happy, upbeat songs. And so I enjoy seeing them in concert. I have actually, they're doing their final tour this fall. Supposedly there's only two left. I think they want to quit before they're just the Monkee. And I've got the tickets to the last show that they're doing in November. I've got tickets. I'm in the pit.
Oh man.
So I'm very excited. It's at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles. So I'll be going out there for that.
Yeah. You probably got your tickets online. You didn't sit out overnight like we used to do.
Oh, God. Like you used to go to Hex and stand outside at Hex at the Golden Ring Mall. Yeah. I remember doing that. Yes. I remember doing that. And you get to the window. You're too away from the window. They say, "Sorry, we're all sold out." Like, wait, what? Yeah. I've been here all night. You can't do that. I did that many times.
How many times we did that, right?
Oh God, yeah. So yes, I that was all online. Now it's very. Now you are stating our ages. Yes, I think a lot of you were going, "Wait, you guys did that?" Yeah, that's what we see. You wanted to see a band live. That's what you did.
That's right.
I'd forgotten about that. That's very funny. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, who did you go to see back in the day? Who are you? A big fan of back in the day.
Oh gosh. Well, my very first concert was Van Halen.
Oh, nice. Nice. That's a good one. First. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Who opened for them?
Yep.
Who was the opening band?
I don't remember, but I remember Maureen Wilson and I lied to our parents. I told my parents I was spending the night with her.
I did. Maureen's. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah, she of course. Was spending the night at my house and we totally got busted, but it was so worth it because I got
so funny.
Van Halen.
Yeah. Where was it? As the Cap Center or where was it? At the Civic Center?
It was at the Civic Center.
Okay. Okay. And my first concert was Kiss at the Cap Center, and AC/DC opened up for them with Bon Scott, and it was a good show.
Yeah.
But we didn't know who AC/DC was at the time. We were just like, "Who are these jokers?" And
it must have been memorable because I don't remember who opened for Van Halen.
I saw Van Halen about 10 years ago, and David Lee Roth was past his prime. Cool and the Gang opened up for them, and it was fun. My wife thought Cool and the Gang was the best thing about the show, and we had a great time with that. And they had a hot dog salesman outside that we really liked. So those were the big highlights of the band, of the concert for us, because. David Lee Roth's voice is gone by that point, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay. But Eddie was still great.
I was a few years back, and I was impressed with Judas Priest opened for Ozzy, and I was really impressed at how strong they still sounded.
Rob Halford's got a great voice. He's got the best voice around. You're not going to go bad with his voice, so I understand that. That's so funny. I had no idea that was your music. Look at you. Very good. See, I'm learning so much about you, Kelly. I'm learning so much about you. I've known you or known of you for 40 years, and now I'm learning your musical tastes. Nice.
Well, that's very funny. I'm going to stop recording now, and then you and I can chit-chat in private.
Okay.
But Dwayne, thank you so much for being on The Word with an inquisitive book nerd. I hope that people will go out and check your book out. They can get it at Amazon. They can get it at any local bookseller. You can ask for it by name. The author is Dwayne Tudall. And don't forget your indie bookstores.
You've been listening to The Word with an inquisitive book nerd with your award-winning author and editor, Kelly White. Stay tuned for other episodes coming up monthly right here on the Chesapeake Podcast Network.